Hello, welcome to My Camino, the podcast. I'm Dan Mullins. Thanks for your enthusiasm in the wake of last week's podcast. I don't often call upon my listeners to lend a hand, but the response was brilliant. So I'll begin this week by saying thank you. Cancer either has or will touch all of us. So thank you from the bottom of my heart. This is a podcast about the Camino de Santiago, or the Way of St. James, a series of pilgrimages across Europe. Things are very slowly returning to normal, but it's going to be a long time before things get back to how they were pre-March 2020. We all couldn't possibly imagine how this year was to unfold. It's been an unprecedented journey for all of us. As one of my correspondents, my old friend Carl, said this week, we're all part of history now. So true, isn't it? When you think about what the future will make of 2020 and COVID-19, it will be a significant event in the timeline of life. That doesn't mean we have to sit back and wait for life to pass us by. As I said 2 weeks ago, life goes on, so make the most of it. One of the things I've loved most about the last 6 months is the presence of friends. It's made friendships closer, more precious, and more special. And I found myself reaching out to friends who need to talk. And I've been lucky enough to hear from friends who are thinking of others. I saw a great quote this week, "A real friend is one who walks in when the rest of the world walks out." And the friends you meet on the Camino have a special resonance. They seem to shine brighter than most. It's because you've entrusted them with part of your journey on the path that is the Camino, and your journey on the path that is life. Keep the lines of communication open. Reach out to pilgrims you haven't heard from in a while. Tell them you're thinking of them. Ask them if they're okay. Bake them an imaginary cake and send them an imaginary hug. Provide your love for safekeeping. I guarantee you there's a pilgrim who will welcome your gesture with open arms and an open heart. Some pilgrims are lucky enough to have been able to make the journey back to the Camino. The rest of us can simply dream. Here in Australia, the government has banned international travel. We don't share borders, international borders, so it's anyone's guess when we'll be able to get back to the Northern Hemisphere. But I received an email from a pilgrim, Audrey Eager, this week. She said she'd just returned from the Camino Primitivo. She'd like to give us an update. Welcome, Audrey.
Thank you. Great to be here.
What you just said about, friends and meeting people and reaching out to pilgrims because, I met a wonderful bunch of people, and if I could sum up this Camino, it was about friendship.
Oh, how lovely. That's fantastic. Was this your first pilgrimage, the Primitivo?
My second. I did, by way of sort of an introduction, and last year I just did that last stretch from Sarria to Santiago on the French Way. So this was definitely up in the stakes and increasing the distance I was going to walk and the hardness of the walk as well.
So where did you start?
I started in Oviedo on the 4th of August. I flew in on the 3rd of August from London into Santander and got the bus across. So quarter's wait on the 4th of August, I was packed up and ready to go.
How lovely. And so how many days did it take you to walk from Oviedo? And did you walk all the way to Santiago?
It took 14 days. All in all, I only had that sort of 2 week gap to or 2 week time frame to actually get it done, and that's why the Primitivo appeals to me, because it's one Camino that you can get done almost in those 2 weeks. And I arrived then on the 16th of August on a Sunday afternoon. I would love to say the sun was splitting in the skies, but the heavens were pouring down upon us. Oh. And it was a very wet Santiago.
So you walked those 14 days. As I understand it, the Primitivo is very beautiful, but it can be very challenging.
I have to agree with you there. Before I went out, I had sat down with guidebooks. I had, read, been on the forums and tried to get some other people's experiences of what it was like. And maybe it was only my own naivety as well that, I just wanted... I live in a flat in central London, and I can tell you that it takes 14 steps to get from the front door to the back wall of my flat and be in here for so many by myself, you know, having one daily walk around central London when there was no hills to practice on. Maybe in my own naivety, I was thinking that it was very much like the flatness of the French Way that I did last year. But then the Primitivo was definitely the first week in the beautiful mountains in the Asturias. But it was hot, which was a challenge. I could see exactly why it gets that name, Primitive, because, you know, it's harder and it's not quite as well serviced as the French Way last year. So, yeah, it was definitely, you know, a step up on what I was doing. But by God, some of that, the Asturias, the mountains in the Asturias was just, when you get up early in the morning and you're leaving between 7:30, 7:00 and the sun hasn't quite come up yet, and you get a little bit of height and suddenly you're above the clouds and you feel like you are almost, you know, reaching up to heaven, and then the sun comes up and burns the cloud away, and it's a beautiful feeling to wake up to every morning.
How lovely, how lovely. You know, when you said it's not as well serviced, I mean, there wouldn't be as many albergues as on the French Way, but how far do you have to walk each night before you can find a bed?
This year, I think, is the exception. I'd say if you were walking, you would easily, you know, I would say the longest stretch I went was about seeing an albergue, probably somewhere between maybe 10 and 15 kilometres.
Oh, okay.
But this year, the challenge was not necessarily where the albergue was. It was the albergue open. And I suppose when I was weighing up, will I or won't I do this Camino, one of the ways to reassure myself was that I actually had pre-booked everything before I went. So I knew where I needed to be at every day. Now, the real happiness for me doing this Camino was actually getting to meet other peregrinos on the Camino. And they were doing it, let's see where we're going and let's stop where we need to stop. And if I want to stop a bit earlier today, I'll stop a bit earlier today. And then it just sort of, the conversation I could hear around them was actually, we need to make sure that the albergues are open, you know? So they did probably a little bit of pre-planning maybe the day before to look at where would they go the next day and where would they stay. So that was definitely, I suppose, you know, a change in adapting to this new norm of walking the Camino, just to be a little bit more aware of, you know, where was open, where was not open.
So if you walk the Camino Frances or the last 100 kilometres of the Frances before, and then you would have walked at least some of the end of the Frances this time around to walk into Santiago, how did it compare in terms of numbers from last year to this year?
On the French Way, so we hit the French Way, if anybody knows that route, when you hit to Malaita. And yeah. I have heard about this feeling, but I didn't experience it last year. But suddenly when you come off the quietness of another Camino, and suddenly when they all start to converge all in one, there are people around you. And it is, you know, we had at this stage created our own little bubble and we're in our own little world. And then there's lots of other people around you suddenly. But comparing, like last year, I went at the same time in August and it was much quieter, I felt. I don't know what the Primitivo was like. One of the reasons why I also picked the Primitivo was it's the quietest one. So your chances of actually meeting people were slimmer. But you know, even I must have passed on that route. So I stayed in, say, after Malaita, carried on to Buenta. And that route, Buenta, through to Via Arsua, up into El Pedruso, easily passed about 3 or 4 bars that were closed. Mm. Comparing that to the Primitivo, and the Primitivo, you know, there were days when it was so hot, and there was nowhere to refill your water, which actually I thought was maybe slightly on the dangerous side. I was taking, you know, 2 litres in my rucksack, have a can of Aquarius with me, and then have another little, beaker if I found somewhere where I could get some aqua potable from a well somewhere. And then you just go in that heat, just absolutely just devour and drink up that water. And so the contrast then, when you go from no water to suddenly, even though it's not as quiet as busy, sorry, it's not as busy as previous years, but there's still places where you can go and sit out and relax and enjoy the walk, you know, and it's not quite so much pressurized. But numbers on the French Way, definitely down on what I saw last year, which was sad in its own way, but it was also, there were still people, so there was still life.
Yeah. You mentioned at the very top of the interview about friendship, and you've just mentioned then we created this little bubble. Did you go as a group, or did you meet these friends on the Primitivo? Tell us the story about the friendship.
This was, for me, the human side of wanting to do the Camino was sort of to begin with the escape from the flat and an escape from the city, and also, well, in amongst all this pandemic and COVID and all of that, you know, we are all as individuals trying to do our best to, you know, to stop this from spreading, and we've all made sacrifices. And no, the conversation that, you know, I don't think has been spoken about enough during all of this is actually what has done this to our mental health. And, you know, if you're working from home and you've lost that contact with your colleagues around you, you've lost your social life. You know, people have left cities and gone back home to their families and worked from there. And one of the aspects that I found that came through is a sense of loneliness. And to do the Camino was sort of, I need to get away and I just need to be out in the open. And I you know, one of the things I really love about the Camino is that when you pass people by and you say Buen Camino, it evokes that sense of community, and it's respect, and you're looking out for the people who you're passing by. And the Camino also offers you the chance where you can walk by yourself, and for whatever reason that you want to walk by yourself, it's still a safe environment in amongst the pandemic. That's how I was looking at it. So even the morning I started in Oviedo, there were a group of three two lads and a girl. And again, you know, we all started off this morning. We don't know each other. We're walking at different paces, but we spent the day crisscrossing each other.
Yeah.
And got to say hello to them in the afternoon. And they were two 18-year-old lads from the Basque Country, spoke fluent English, and they're friends. And then you just spend every day sort of, you know, I didn't see them, I think, for another 2 days. And then I'd met randomly, you know, one morning, another Irish girl who was actually living in Valencia. And I didn't see her for another 2 days. And then sort of you begin to recognize the faces. You could see people walking by themselves. And after about 5 days, I'd say 6 days or so, suddenly then I met the Irish girl again, and she had met other people. And I saw the Basque boys, as I said, to call them, and they came I introduced them to this Irish girl and to the rest of the people who were meeting. And, you know, we were all individuals, pretty much, who were there to do the Camino for their own particular reasons. And I think after a couple of days, you sort of, you know, do look at each other and go, well, you look healthy. You don't look like you've got COVID. So actually talk to each other more. And as we got to the end of the first week into the second week, which, you know, when you do these routes and you realize that you are that group of people who are doing that particular stretch of the Camino at that particular on that particular day, and you're sharing that experience together. And if you pass somebody that's suddenly looking very tired and you stop and have a chat with them, like, oh, come on, yes, you can do it, you know, we're nearly there. You know, that was that outreach and the support that we gave each other. And in the evenings then we would come together and have dinner. And that was a bit of a challenge because a lot of the restrictions along the Camino was, you know, we were about 13 people, and, you know, trying to find a restaurant that might take a group of 13 people was a bit on the harder side, and trying to find places maybe that were outdoors. So, you know, we were trying to be really respectful to all the local rules as well, but also, you know, as we got talking, I think one of the joys of the Camino was actually getting to hear and listen to people's life stories and what's their motivation for doing the Camino in the middle of a pandemic. You know, there were two girls who flew in from Holland. There were two cousins from Venezuela who were living in Barcelona. There was an Italian guy living in Barcelona. There were a brother and sister and their friend also from the Basque Country, a guy from the Navarre, two friends who had flown in from Argentina, as it happened. So there were two French guys along the route as well. So it really was that I saw the best of what Camino is in bringing people together at this time in history. As you mentioned, we are now living in history. And for whatever reasons, and everybody's got their own reasons, you know, we would walk separately during the day because, as you say, the Camino is about you're probably all bringing something to the Camino that you want to get sorted out in your head, as much as it's for exercise or, you know, for seeing the beautiful countryside, for whatever the motivation is. So we were very respectful to not encroach on each other's spaces as well. But then when we needed to be social, you know, this was a Camino I described as done by WhatsApp. We had a WhatsApp group. So if what happened, myself included, if you sort of ignore by accident one of the markers and you suddenly find yourself going down a different direction that you shouldn't be going in, and, you know, the moderns of modern technology, go on the WhatsApp group and ask somebody, can you send me your live location so I can get myself back to where I need to be? You know, and we've stayed in touch since we've come back. And, you know, we're back now, nearly coming up to a month. Some of the group went on to Fisteria. And, you know, it was great to see how the continuation of their journey as well. And we were almost with them as they carried on their Camino. And it was just that. It was such an up year where, you know, human contact has been very limited. And just to put it into perspective, even for myself, from mid-March up until the Camino, I had only come in contact with 10 people in the flesh since mid-March. And it's not a way to live. And so this Camino, very much on the human side of it, was a wonderful experience. So actually see the best in people as we were walking along.
What do you do in London? What's an Irish girl doing in London?
Now, that's a long story. I describe my background as professionally because I came here for work back in 2012. As you know, I had a career and I have a passion. My career was in travel, so I've spent more than 12 years working overseas with a tour operator, actually specialising in the summer seasons and walking holidays, as it turned out. And I was in Andorra for a couple of years, then I moved over to the French Alps, and then I moved to London to stay. And then I call my passion, actually, what I call my other career is my career in politics. So in 2016, I actually moved back into politics in London and was working on the Brexit referendum, as it happened. So that was 4 years up until this March, and things quietened down. Well, a lot seems to be picking up again at the moment. So, you know, very, very, that's a whole different kind of podcast.
Yes, but it might very well be a different kind of podcast, but it's very important when we talk about you, Audrey Eger. Because I want to say, this is very important, right? So, and I had a list of questions here. I didn't know that you were going to say Brexit. And I didn't know that you had political passion, as you put it. Because I have here, you know, you're Irish, you live in London. How did all that come about? My next question is, Catholicism rings loud in the Irish psyche and has done for centuries and centuries, as you know. How do you view Ireland from afar now?
I'm very proud of Ireland. I'm a very proud Irish woman. It's the one thing that everybody, you know, if you were to, do you know this question when you go for a job interview and they say, how would your colleagues describe you? And I could tell on a very personal level, my colleagues would say first, oh, she's Irish. You know, it's the accent has always given. I feel very privileged and lucky to be Irish. Now, the question of how I look on Ireland, and if you're in the prism of Catholicism and the Catholic Church,
yeah,
you know, Ireland isn't a country that is ruled or dictated to by the Catholic Church as an institution anymore. But, you know, what we have is quite a spiritual people.
Mm.
People don't go to Mass anymore. If they go to Mass, it's probably because they choose to go to Mass. And they're two different things. But that last year when I did that, the Camino, for me, that really was an exploration of that side of, you know, the spiritual side of the Camino. I really enjoyed going into churches, and I went to the Masses as much as possible. You know, I really would stop and, you know, smell the roses. Going into a church was to almost sit down and just pause and reflect on where I was at or how I was feeling, even if it was just how's that blister on my foot feeling, am I doing okay?
Yeah.
This time around actually was a different Camino because it is the Primitivo. You know, there aren't many churches along that way. The culture around it was different in that you weren't, you know, it wasn't the Camino where last year where you would go and you'd go to the Camino Mass and get your sayo, you know, that wasn't part of the experience. I remember when I got into Santiago and tired and hungry and emotional, and you know, and some people were like, oh, I just need to go and get food, or I just need to get a shower. I was like, no, I really want to get into the pilgrim's office. I want my Compostela, because I made a mistake last year. I went for my Compostela the day after I arrived, and I missed at the pilgrim's mass hearing Ireland being called out on the list of countries where the peregrinos had come from. And so I really wanted to have that experience this time. And I know that was a very personal thing for me, that, you know, a lot of this, the group I had come to know weren't quite on that, you know, weren't having that same similar experience. But that was just something that I wanted to hear for myself in a church. And, you know, it is the when I would say to friends in living in London, you know, oh, I'm going to do the Camino, and they'd go, oh, well, I've never heard of the Camino. I'm like, well, in Ireland, it's actually really popular, because it is not just about the Catholicism. It is about the headspace and, you know, the therapy that also goes behind taking some time out for yourself, taking your time out away from this modern busy life where you're not on your phone all the time and not on your computer, not on your emails and all of that. You know, almost sounds a cliche now, but you know, Ireland is very respectful, I found, of, oh, you're doing the Camino, brilliant, well done, go for it, you know.
Yeah.
But I want to not inquire too much into the reasons as to why you're doing it as well, you know, because it's a very private thing too. But when I look at Ireland and I compare it to here and to the reception that Camino gets, it's two very different things. And I find, you know, one of the things, again, I said I was just a very proud Irish woman. It is a very open country. And if you go back to Brexit and you just see actually over the 100 years that Ireland has been independent, you just see the progress and how far it has come, you know, from being quite, you know, a conservative Catholic country into now being a modern, liberal, progressive, outwardly looking country. And for the size of it, you know, in a small island in the North Atlantic, it really does punch a lot, you know, higher than probably it should, which makes me, you know, I could talk about being a proud Irish woman for hours.
Yeah. Well, you know, one of the things that my next question is actually, how do you think Ireland's relationship with the UK will change when Brexit comes full swing? But it's interesting because when you just said then Ireland punching well above its weight, I was in Ireland in the early 1990s. And in those days, it was starting to develop this this identity as a tech, a kind of like an IT hotbed. And I remember arriving there from Australia going, wow, this is a country, like this country's going crazy. It was the sense in the environment was in the political environment, the entertainment and cultural environment, spiritual environment, every aspect was just that this is a country on the move. And now I've not been back for many years, but I still have family in Tipperary. I have my family that goes back not very far, actually. But I wondered, having seen it for myself in the 1990s and having seen it in full swing when it's like going gangbusters, how do you think Ireland's relationship with the UK will change when Brexit comes into full swing?
I don't think it will change. And I don't think it will change because it already has changed.
Yeah,
and it has changed over the last 100 years. And, you know, this is something that British commentators don't really seem to grasp. They still visualise that Ireland is maybe still in the 1950s. And it hasn't got that sense of how far since the 1990s, through the Celtic Tiger years, how developed it is. You know, there used to be a joke in Ireland that when you used to cross the border in Northern Ireland, you know, they had the better roads. But because of, you know, our positive membership with the European Union and, you know, good strategic use of European funds, for example, when you cross the border now from Northern Ireland and you head down south, you just literally start driving through modern, open European motorways. And you have this, you know, sense of, you know, this is the 21st century.
Yeah.
And it's, you know, it's completely reversed already. And, you know, this British commentators over here still, you know, would... I often think if I touch on the political aspect of it, you know, I'm an Irish person and I get to vote in general elections where other people don't from around the Commonwealth, for example. And that's because they enacted a bill in 1949 when Ireland became a republic. And the essence behind it is that they still considered us to be them or to be part of them when actually Ireland went off as an independent nation and created its own economic policy and moved away from being wholly based on agriculture and, you know, exportish market. And it developed, you know, one of the positive legacies from the Catholic Church is the education system.
Sure, yeah.
And it's not a Catholic system. So we've been able to, you know, regurgitate out highly qualified young graduates to service many different sectors. And it comes from a place of, you know, I was actually just reading up on this the other day from, you know, this was a policy introduced in 1958, actually, that, you know, but it took a long time for it actually to really, you know, come about. And so we are probably very confident in ourselves. And when we look across the Irish Sea to see what's happening with Brexit, and over the last couple of years, when I would say to you know, friends or family or the taxi driver going to the airport and they ask you, what do you work on? And I would say, well, I work in politics and I'm working in the campaign to stop Brexit. And they'd go turn around to me and say, like, what are they doing over there? Are they mad? Do they not know? Do they not see what they're doing is absolute craziness? And so there was a lot of scratching of the heads going, you know, how did it get this far? And it's not that far because the education system in the UK doesn't incorporate in really teaching the positives of being in European membership. You know, it hasn't even had a conversation with itself about the impacts the British Empire had around the world, you know. So in the absence of there being a vacuum of the right information, it's allowed other people come in and come up with this narrative, and it's been wrong. And on top of that, then you have a society that has felt very left behind, and you touch on the anger, and the anger wants to point a finger at something, and it became the European Union. And, the very basic psychology is that people are looking for somebody to blame, and the European Union was that something to blame. But it is, I think now, if you talk to Irish people living in Ireland now and other people living in Ireland, and they would look at the UK and what's happening, and they go, God, it is very sad. But you know what? Leave them to it, because it's not our problem. Our problem now is to make the most of this situation.
Yeah.
And to come through it. And we're a country and a people of surviving. We're survivors. Within our DNA, we know what our history is. We know the battles and the fights we've had. And we know tough times and we know good times. And we just get our head down and get on with it. Now, and that's something that I see in Britain. I worry about, the social cohesiveness of the country and about whether they can actually have the capability to come true what's going to be, on top of the pandemic, a very hard recession. And people are losing their jobs everywhere at the moment, and it's very sad to see. But within themselves, are they a nation that will just crumble under the weight of it, or, like the Irish, will get their heads down and get on with it?
Yeah.
But definitely from an Irish perspective, it is sort of now at this point, it's, we just crack on with whatever we were cracking on beforehand.
It was funny, you just said something in there, Audrey. You said the Irish have been through tough times and good times. It's interesting because if I think about Irish people, and I've known many and love many, they are tough and they love a good time. And I think that their culture and the spirituality of the culture enables them to see the good in the bad and the bad in the good. And I wonder what somebody who works in tourism and really sells culture, that's part of what you do, you're encouraging people to go off and see other parts of the world and experience culture and the spirit of other people's lives and their ingenuity and their culture. What did you make of the slow tourism of pilgrimage, the walking to the beat of your heart, traveling really at a very, very slow pace through another culture and observing it as a visitor?
That's the part I enjoy the most. Particularly on the Camino, you're only going at 4 kilometres an hour walking on a good day, because I find there's could be a lot of distractions. And when, I love the Camino for really getting to know the people, but, to sit there and even enjoy the local food. As somebody who's worked previously in tourism, people need different things from a holiday. And sometimes that just means you're working flat out for 11 months of the year and, you want some time just to sit by the pool and read a very easy book. And there's sometimes where you actually want to read a good, solid, heavy-going book as well. You need to be intellectually fulfilled and satisfied as well when you're on holiday. So that's what I find about the Camino, because it is slowly moving and you can slowly get a feel for the place. And, people have asked me where, would I not move back to Ireland, or would I not move back to France, or different places where I've lived in the past. On a very gut and instinctive level, I've got to get a sense of the people and the soul of the place. And if it appeals to me, I'm very interested and I go back to the place again. As a traveller, some people, for example, will like to go on city breaks and they'll just do a weekend in a European city, or for example. And I tend to stay away from that, because what will happen is that I will get a feel for a place, I'll start researching it, and suddenly I get this idea in my head going, what would that be like to live there?
Yeah.
So take it to the next level. So sometimes it's best to stay away from those city breaks in order to be able to manage, exactly where you're living in the here and now and the present.
That's such a great answer. I love that because, you know, every time I go to London, I think, I'll just come back and live for a year, just a year. And then every time I'm in Paris, I think I'll go and live for a year. Even Madrid, I think, oh, I'll just go and live for a year. It'd be fantastic, wouldn't it? Just be fantastic. But living in Sydney is a pretty good place to live, so I really should just count my blessings, I think. Hey, tell
me. Yeah, Australia's not somewhere I've ever been to, so, you know, if I ever do, will I come back?
Honestly, you know what, Audrey Eger? You may very well end up here for good because there's lots of beautiful Irish people here who love it. They absolutely love it because there's a lot of Irish culture here. There's a lot of Irish sensibility in all of us. I'm Irish. Irish stock from years, centuries. But the one thing you have to do when you come down here is bring a hat.
Oh, absolutely. I am an Irish fair skins lady. And, yeah. You know, I get lobsterized very easily.
Oh, yeah, yeah, and, yeah.
And you talk about Irish people away, but do you know what? One of the things I really enjoy about the Camino is you don't find an Irish pub along the Camino, which, as an Irish person, makes a lovely change.
Do you know there is one?
There is? Where?
There is one in Sahun, S-A-H-A-G-U-N, Sagahun. It's a classic Irish pub. Yeah. Yeah.
So maybe one day I'll stick my head in the door.
Yeah. Yeah. Sells Guinness and the whole bit. Yeah. 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 It's just like a block from the municipal albergue. It's called something like Molly Malone's or something like that.
Of course it would be.
I actually played, I sang in there. I took my guitar and sat up in the corner and played all night, sang all night in there. It was great fun. Tell us about arriving in Santiago, the Obrador Square in front of that majestic cathedral. You were only there a couple of weeks ago. Tell us all about it.
It was a Sunday afternoon and we had sort of leisurely done the 20 kilometres from Opedruso. And at this stage, there were one or two of us that were carrying some niggles and a few sore muscles. So we weren't really, this was the last day and it was slightly tinged with a little bit of sadness because it was also coming to an end. It's a compare and contrast to last year. Last year I was by myself when I arrived in, but you know, that's the way I wanted it because last year I was like a sponge. I just wanted to take in as much as I possibly could, where this year it was a different Camino. This was almost the point that I remembered so well from last year. And the journey, the walk in felt from Monte de Gozo was, you know, felt a lot shorter. And you sort of, when you cross the road and suddenly you come into the old city, and it's a Sunday afternoon, and you know, I didn't know really what to expect by way of how busy would it be. I really had no expectation of how many people would I expect to see in Santiago. And for sure, it was quieter than last year. Maybe the weather was keeping people away. And no sooner had we began to arrive into the old town that it had slightly been showery on and off for most of the day. But at this point, as the weather apps had said, the heavens opened up and it properly rained down on us. And, you know, as an Irish person, we describe rain in different ways because we're so used to rain, and there's wet rain and there's dry rain and there's soft rain and all those different labels we put to it. But this was proper wet rain. You know, the other Irish girl that was in the group, her Spanish was a lot better than my Spanish would be. And she's explaining to the others exactly what I mean by dry rain and wet rain, because all they saw was rain. So translated. And then when we came down the steps and into the square, you know, the square was in front of the cathedral. It was really quite empty. Now, that could have been that it was raining and there were people underneath the arches at the back. And we had given ourselves a bit of a running joke throughout the whole thing, which was tortilla. For some reason, everywhere we went, there was tortilla, whether it was free tapas or what was on the menu, or, you know, there was tortilla, and we were like trying to have a day where there was no tortilla, but the tortilla would just appear. So that was our running joke. So when we sort of, we were toasting or cheering ourselves, you know, the word tortilla was shouted out, which is very hard to explain to other people unless you were there. And when we did arrive into the square, and of course we were, you know, doing the usual whoop whoops and, you know, hollering around. And I think what struck me really was that because we were the only people actually in the centre of the square at that time, the people who were taking sheltering from the rain under the arches, there was like this spontaneous clap across from the arches. And it's like, there's our welcoming party. And, you know, that's not normal, I felt. You know, that's something that's unique for us, which I found quite moving, you know. And, you know, it was last year when I arrived in the square, I remember I just sat on the ground and, you know, took a video of myself and messaged a few people and said, hey, I've done it, you know. And this time around, I felt like there was more adrenaline inside me. And I was like, well, we've done it, you know. And I was curious to see the reaction of the rest of the group. Would other people be emotional? Would they just be tired, grateful? You know, that I was very interested in seeing how the rest of the group would react. And say there were three or four people who had done the Camino before, so they knew what to expect. But for, you know, for the first timers, you know, there is probably more of a sense of relief. And can we get out of the rain now? Type of a feeling on that arrival. And then we hid under the arches to get out of the rain. You know, took a few photographs, and we did two group photographs together. We were still very much contained in our own space as well. The big thing was, obviously, everywhere you go, you must wear the mask.
Right,
so
yeah.
All the photographs we're all got the masks on. And no matter where you go, in the Asturias and Galicia even more stricter than the Asturias is, but when it's a public space, you must wear your mask. You will get fined, and it's not worth risking the fine. And you'll get used to it, and it doesn't become a thing after a while. You know, just if you want to experience the Camino in this current environment, wear your mask. So I went down to the Parish Pilgrims office after that, and that was actually busier than I was expecting. And I presume that was probably due to the time of the day. You know, after about, you know, 2 o'clock, a lot of people will arrive in. So I did have to wait around, and that was extremely well organized. And it took about an hour to get it,
okay,
which was a lot shorter than last year. Last year took 7 hours. So, you know, and then, you know, you just walking around the streets. It unfortunately kept raining for the rest of the day. And so the streets were quieter. And but it was, I can't lie, I was happy to arrive in Santiago. I think after doing 320 kilometres, I was glad to see it.
Hey, can I just ask a really silly question? If you're required to wear a mask everywhere you go, what happens when your group then gets your certificate and meets for lunch? Are you all sitting around the table with a mask on and pulling the mask down to take food into your mouth and then putting the mask back on? Or what happens when you sit down to eat?
This was the part that when we were actually walking during the day, as a group, we, you know, I probably think we came together once at lunch. The mask, you know, like for me and my backpack on the little side pocket, I had my mask in there and it was ready to come out within seconds. And when you're sitting down and, you know, the rule, it's even in Galicia, had changed by the time we got there, that you were expected to wear your mask up until the point where your food or drink was put in front of you.
Okay, right.
So if you're sitting around a table, you were still expected to have your mask on if you were having a conversation.
Yeah, right. Okay, right. Okay, that makes sense. Oh, look, I just talking to you just makes me want to go back tomorrow. But as I said,
I want to go back tomorrow.
So that was my next question. What's in the future, Audrey? What would you like to do next? You've done a little bit of the Frances, or enough of the Frances, perhaps, and now the Primitivo. What's next? What would you like to do?
It's 50-50 in between the Portuguese one or the Camino del Norte one.
Oh, yeah.
But I need to do sort of a bit more research on it. And I think, the practicalities of real life come into here now is how much time would I have to dedicate to it? So I, want to make the most of my time there doing it. So whichever Camino would fit in with that. They're the two. I would love to do the full French way, but in its entirety. But I might have to do that, when I've got more time. And I know some people break it up over several years. And when I'm doing something, I like to do it. I like to do it all in one go. I like the feeling of here I am on day one at the starting point, and I've done the physical challenge and the mental challenge of actually getting me to the end. I like that journey. So I think the Portuguese or the Camino del Norte could be possibly the two for the future.
Well, look, I thoroughly enjoyed talking with you, Audrey. Thank you so much for reaching out and getting in touch and for bringing us up to date on what's happening right now. I think you said that you arrived on the 16th of August, Sunday afternoon. That's only really 3 weeks ago. So I really appreciate it. And I really appreciate you taking some time out early on a Friday morning. The time difference between Sydney and London is pretty awful, really, when you're trying to speak to somebody on a podcast. So I really appreciate it. It's been a great pleasure talking to you. And I hope that you have many, many Caminos in future. And I hope that, well, one day life gets back to normal for all of us. In the meantime, buen Camino.
Buen Camino.
My guest this week, the Irish pilgrim who lives in London, Audrey Eager. Reach out to a friend. Tell them that you love them, that you miss them, that you care about them. Most importantly, that you're thinking of them. I love my quote from this week. A real friend is one who walks in when the rest of the world walks out. Until next week, I'm Dan Mullins. Buen Camino.
Somewhere along the way, somewhere along the way.